Gabriel Byrne's memoir is Walking with Ghosts. So you could think, to put it crudely, a book that's somewhere between Angela's Ashes and David Niven's The Moon's a Balloon. Tales of the movie star life, as we said, interspersed with meticulously and poetically observed aspects of growing up on Struggle Street in Ireland in a modest suburb of Dublin. As well as working with some of cinema's best-known directors, Gabriel Byrne's received 3 Tony nominations for his roles on Broadway, 3 Emmy nominations for his most recent work. He produced the hit movie In the Name of the Father. People magazine once called him one of the sexiest men alive. Gabriel Byrne, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Critics love your book. The big critics and the big newspapers, they really do. How heartening.
You know, I was nervous about putting it out, to be honest, Jim, because there's a lot in the book that, you know, when I wrote it, I thought to myself, do I really want to put this out into the world and have to talk about it? But I was determined to be truthful about it.
Your late parents, Eileen and Dan, and your late sister, Marion, would be proud of this book and your place in their lives and their place in your life, I would think.
Well, I'd love to think that. You know, they were, my father was a working class man who was made redundant at 46, 47. His life stopped. His whole identity was working. You know, he worked in the Guinness factory making wooden barrels. He was a laborer there. And his days were filled with companionship and work and so forth, and all that that does to the soul, to the identity. And then suddenly it stopped and there's nothing. And my mother was a nurse and she had to go back to work. So my father had to kind of be, long before it was fashionable to be kind of a house husband, which he was ill suited for, but he embraced with great enthusiasm. And my sister, who died at 32, I talk about her in the book and how she struggled with mental illness, which to a great extent were not understood at the time. But I decided to write about her because mental illness at that time in Ireland, and still to a great extent, and I think it may be true also in New Zealand. I mean, you have a beautiful writer from New Zealand called Janet Frame, who wrote astoundingly well about mental illness. And I wanted to break the silence that surrounded her illness. But the book itself is, yes, it deals with dark themes, but it also deals, I think, with other areas which I hope transcend the world of acting and cinema and also the world of Ireland.
On the very first page of your book, you talk about the hill you used to dream on as a lad. You show us immediately that you can write, you're a poetic and natural writer, and you use the word melancholy to describe your feelings. And you may not like that word applied to your acting, but often it has been opposite. Often there have been roles in which we see the pain of living in your character and through your roles.
That's a good observation. Melancholy might be another word for sadness or deep feeling or pain or suffering. I think that's inside me. I also think that it's inside so many people. But we're trained in the culture not to express it very much because, you know, you have to always be on your game and smiling and up and so forth. But I think that the experience of life, to a great extent, is about sadness and pain. That's not to say that it's not also full of joy. But I think that the characters I have tended to play have been deeply felt characters who exhibit their pain. So it's a good point that you make, Jim.
And on your boyhood hill, you learned to notice small things, to see the small joys of the world that have sustained you mentally, and they still do. The hawk's feather you found snagged on a briar bush, the taste of blackberries after rain. You've learned to counter the melancholy that's risen to the surface of your Irishness.
I think there's a quote by Isaac Newton, which is not really very well known. And there I was, playing on the seashore, looking for a smoother, finer pebble, when all around me the great ocean of truth lay undiscovered. And what he's saying there is that, you know, you can concentrate on the small things of life. Does it give you a great truth? I don't know. But I would also agree with William Blake that the universe is in a grain of sand. So if you find, as I did and remembered, a hawk's feather snagged on a briar, that makes me think of so many things. Like, why would a hawk lose a feather? Did the hawk know that it had lost the feather? What would have happened to that feather if I hadn't come across it and kept it as a souvenir? Where was the hawk going? Where was it coming from? Why did it land on that particular branch of the bush? But I talk about that in contrast to concrete and how I have never loved concrete as I love a tree. And I have always been drawn to the smallest things. And I still look for the smallest things, the things that we tend to overlook. Yesterday, I said to my wife, you know, we have a donkey here, and she was trying to get into where the donkey, you know, has its food. And she just pushed the donkey to the side, and the donkey blinked twice. And I said, did you notice the way the donkey blinked twice? And she said, no, I didn't. What do you think that meant? And I said, I think the two blinks meant I'm being pushed out of the way. But I'm looking for those moments all the time. And I think they're better suited to writing than they are to, say, acting. You can't really use that. But you could use a moment like that in writing or in poetry.
The donkey blinked twice. The title of your book is about the baggage we want, some of us of a certain disposition perhaps, the baggage of people in our lives that we want or have to carry with us through life and through time, keeping the memories of them alive, trying to keep them in the frame of time because we're all washed away by it in the end. That's what you're after with Walking with Ghosts?
Yes, absolutely. I got the idea for the title and maybe for the book from a Native American Indian. I was on a walk in Ireland with John Pilger and a few other people to commemorate the great famine that happened in Ireland in 1845, where the population was halved by starvation and immigration. And it's a great wound on the psyche of the Irish people. It's the reason why so many people went to New Zealand, Australia, England. And he said before we started the walk, he said, remember, we never walk alone. We walk with the ghosts and the spirits of our ancestors and the memories of what has gone before us. And it really struck me because even though they may not be physically there, they are in a way through the memory of them, they are walking with you. And my father, my mother, my sister, all the friends that I have lost, I feel walk with me and talk to me, maybe not in recognizable human ways, but they do talk and they do walk with me. And there's a kind of a comfort in knowing that one isn't cut off from the past because people have moved on. I was doing a film where I had to work in a pathologist's office. And the man who was in charge of the mortuary, I asked him what it was like to do that job. And he said, well, I'm the last person to touch this body before they move on into the next world. And I regard that as a profound privilege. And he said a very interesting thing. He said, sometimes I will leave a body before I attend to it because the spirit of the body is still there. And I said, well, do you believe in the spirit of the body? He said, absolutely. I can tell by looking at a body when it comes into the mortuary if that person has met a quick death or not. He says, the energy is trapped there. I said, well, do you believe that there are things like ghosts or spirits? He said, not in the traditional way that we mean it. He said, but the spirit of people remains. And this was a man who worked on the very cold face of death. So I believe that those people who have passed on are with us, and they inform our present. And I'm not by any means a religious person. I'm not. I just do believe in that particular aspect, that we all walk with ghosts, and it can be the ghost also of regret, the ghost of sorrow, the ghost of joy, the ghost of a landscape. Everything that is past and is gone is still within us, because who we are is who we were.
You're an atheist now, but the name Gabriel means man of God, and for a time you were.
I was, yes. Ireland at that time was a very, very religious country. It almost wasn't even religious. I know that sounds paradoxical to say that, but it was so embedded in the cultural fabric of the world that I grew up on that to become a priest wasn't a great stretch. It was regarded as a reward from God to a God-fearing family. So at 11 years of age, these priests came to the school and showed us these photographs of guys in straw hats, piloting planes and going up rivers and, generally being like Indiana Jones. And at 11 years of age, you think, God, that sounds like a great job. I'd like to be one of those guys. And you put up your hand and you say, I'll go. And then you find yourself on a boat going to another country at 11 years of age to become a priest. Well, did I know what I was doing? Of course I didn't. When you believe without question, it answers many of the complex questions of life very simply. If you don't believe, you have to search. And I do believe that the journey through life is a journey of searching and revelation. And you may never find the answer, but it doesn't matter. The quest is what's important.
I looked up the Archangel Gabriel, and he is said to appear to certain people in their sleep, as with your mother.
Yeah, well, my mother told me the story of how she came to give me my name. When she was pregnant, she lay down on the couch to have a bit of a sleep one afternoon. And when she came to, she went to the curtains and she opened them, and it was a night had fallen and snow had come into the garden. And she saw this form materialize out of the snow and land on the bicycle shed. And it had a pair of white wings and it tapped on the window. And she said, I couldn't hear what this angel was saying to me, but that was the first time I ever said your name. And that's how she came to call me that name. And I knew nobody else in the entire country of Ireland up until the age of maybe 14 or 15 who was called that name. And I used to be kind of a bit like, I guess I suppose a lot of teenagers get their names and they think, Jesus, why was I called Hubert? Or, why was I called Seamus? Why wasn't I called like some really hip, cool name? And I used to think, why was I called Gabriel? And I remember my father saying, it could have been worse. It could have been called Raphael, who was the other archangel. And I then came to love it. And now, weirdly enough, Jim, it's a kind of a hip name. Mick Jagger's child is called Gabriel. And anybody who has that name, congratulations. I think it's a lovely name.
Yeah, it's a lovely name. There is something about Irish honesty. Your first big movie came out, Defence of the Realm, and you were fielding questions at some sort of gathering, and your own mother stood up and said what?
It was a packed hall, and my first film had just come out, and it was a big success. And at that time, no Irish actor had ever really made a big film in England in a leading role, playing an English part. And so it was a big deal for the home crowd, And outside the cinema, I always remember looking at, the hoarding outside with a mixture of pride and mortification, which kind of sums up my character. And it said, for 3 weeks only, Ireland's own Gabriel Byrne in Defence of the Realm. So I was doing a public kind of interview with this town hall, and at the end the moderator said, now we'll open it up to the audience. That lady in the second row, And I looked down and I said, it's my mother. What is she standing up for? I didn't say this, but that's what I was thinking. And she said, the woman said, yes, what's your name? She said, well, I'm Gabriel's mother. And the audience went, oh, well, no, it's his mother. She said, I'd like to ask a question. I'd like to ask himself. Why don't you tell them about the time you got diarrhea on your first communion day and you hid behind Delaney's wall and I had to bring you home?
Imagine how you felt.
Well, the thing about it is that, you know, people say that Irish mothers have a way of putting you in your place and making sure that you don't rise above your station. But and then my mother reminds me of my first communion day, which for those people who aren't Catholic, basically at 7 years of age, you make your first Holy Communion. And more importantly, your aunts and uncles and neighbours and friends all give you money. And you're weighed down with coins. And all I wanted to do was eat chocolates and drink. I never had a Coca-Cola before. Drink Coca-Cola was coming out my nose because of the... And I drank, I ate every sweet that I could possibly eat. And as I was coming home, my internal organs decided to rebel. And that's when I went behind Delaney's wall and let nature take its course, but was too mortified to come out. And it was my mother who found me there. So I had to tell that goddamn story in front of 300 people who howled with delight. And my mother was almost like taking a standing ovation for putting me in my place.
Just hearing you talk, the whole world loves the Irish accent now, seems to, but there was a time in the early 80s when it didn't.
Yeah, very true. I mean... Like, I remember once an English director said to me, yeah, that's wonderful, wonderful, Gabriel. Can we do something about the accent? Oh, here's a good one. This is true. I was, when I went there first, my agent said to me, you know, you'll have to lose your accent. You can't be auditioning for parts with an Irish accent going off. Go to this woman that everybody goes to. She lives in Richmond. Here's her number. So I went out and I did classes with her. How now, brown cow? And, you know, a gregarious gaggle of geese were giggling their way to Uganda. You know, nonsense, bullshit things. And I was desperately trying to get the received English accent into my head. So she said, now, what I want you to do is go out and talk to people at parties and, you know, get comfortable with this accent. But I couldn't do that, so I tried it out on a couple of Indian guys who worked in supermarkets and things, and I'd say it, and they wouldn't notice any difference, so I'd get, like, a bit more confident. So one day I met this actor, and I didn't know the bloke, so I went up and I introduced myself to him in this accent that I paid a lot of money to cultivate. And I said to him, hello, it's nice to meet you. I've always admired your work. And he says to me, well, actually, he says, we're going out your way soon. We're going on a tour. And I thought, what's he talking about, going out on a tour? He says, yeah, we're starting off in Adelaide and we're going to Sydney and then we're going over to your place, over to New Zealand. He says, you're from New Zealand, aren't you? I said, no. And my accent completely collapsed. And I said, if this guy thinks I'm from New Zealand, then I need to get money back from this woman in Richmond.
That is a great story. You rose above that station 2 days after a photo shoot with Gianni Versace wearing his clothes, which happens when you're doing a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. Something terrible occurs.
Well, I had never been to a fashion show before, and we were filming in Paris. We were doing a film called The Man in the Iron Mask, and the word came down that Gianni Versace wanted to dress myself and Leonardo for this fashion show on the Sunday night, and he made me a suit. He came in, you know, he was he had that stubble, which at that time wasn't terribly fashionable, but on him it looked, of course, incredibly fashionable. He had a little dog in his arm. And he had a guy writing down my measurements and another guy taking them. And he said, you know, something like, things I couldn't understand. And he went away. The next day, a suit arrived, and we were seated at his table. And after about 2 hours, where all these models came up and they were draping him and kissing him, and, you know, Naomi Campbell was there with jewelry, you know, swinging off her ears and saying, "I love you, Johnny." And he said to me, "I am very tired." I always remember the way he said "tired." "I am so tired. I go back in my house in Miami. Have a big holiday." And I said, "You know, you deserve it. I've never seen anybody to work so hard as you did putting this show together. It's astonishing what you have to do and measure these clothes. And then on top of that, you do a suit for me and Leonardo. Thank you so much. You really deserve it." 3 days later, he was assassinated coming home from his morning coffee. And this lunatic who had some kind of a grudge against him, some kind of a stalker, just as he was going in the gate to his house, called his name, and he turned around and he shot him dead on the steps of his own house. Mm. And that came as a real shock to me, really, really shocking, because, I mean, 2 days before, I was talking to the man, didn't know him terribly well, didn't have much more than a superficial conversation with him, but he was dead. And the guy that they arrested, it turned out, had a list in his pocket of people that he was going to assassinate. And one of the people on that list was Leonardo DiCaprio.
It's a chilling story. Fame, Richard Burton told you when you were drinking with him on a movie in Venice, about which you were very excited because you'd never flown on a plane before. Fame doesn't change you. It changes the people you know. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. I do, absolutely. That's why people think if they get famous that everything's going to be totally cool. Well, what happens is that nothing inside you changes. That fame doesn't change the inside of anybody. It's like saying to somebody, "Listen, if you get that new suit, you're going to be a totally different person." You get the new suit, it looks amazing, and you think, "Wow, this is incredible." But after you've worn it once or twice, the suit, you're still the same person inside the suit. And fame is like a beautiful suit that you put on, and it changes everybody around you. And I'm talking about people who are mega, mega famous, who can't go down the street to get a sandwich, but they're, you know, inundated with people wanting to talk to them and so forth. But any kind of fame, people change. You're on a bicycle one day going to the shops and nobody pays any attention to you. You're on one of these things or in a film, and the next thing, everybody knows who you are. So he was saying to me, beware of that, because fame, as exhibited by the crowd, is a very illusory and fickle thing. And one of the first things that people do when they get really famous is they buy a big house and they lock themselves away. They're not sitting in pubs waiting to be recognized. Mm. He was a man who was world famous. And when I saw him, we came out of the hotel one morning to start work at around 5 o'clock in the morning. It was just coming up to 5 o'clock. And there were maybe 100 photographers outside this small hotel in Austria. And it was at a time when he was split from Elizabeth Taylor. And everybody wanted to know, was he going to get back with Elizabeth Taylor and all this kind of stuff. And it was so cold that a cameraman's finger stuck to the steel lens of his camera. So we were rushing to get into this minibus. And there was 100 photographers pushing each other, pushing in. And I just thought, oh, my God. And when he fell into the car with this look, this stricken look on his face, and he put his fingers to his eyes, and he just let out this sigh, and I thought, oh, my God, this is the reality of it. This is what it's really like. And that night when we got drunk, he said to me, be very careful, because you could become famous, or you could become semi-famous, or you may not become famous at all. But you have to be very careful not to lust after fame, because it is a drink that you take, first of all, because it tastes good. And then you need to taste it. And then it turns into a poison that you can't stop drinking. And he said, look, if I had my time to live over again, I would have become a writer, because that's what I love. He said, I love to write. And I never forgot that conversation because he was a hero of mine. And anytime I see somebody like, say, you know, Britney Spears, or any person who's hunted into the ground by paparazzi and, you know, their lives are taken from them, I feel an intense sorrow for them, because I know that the inside of them is screaming and the outside is all that people are interested in. And I've had glimpses of that in my own career, and I've never been comfortable with it. I've never been very interested in doing gigantic studio pictures that get you known instantly around the world. And I've never been that interested in doing things that make you a lot of money very quickly, because there's always a price to be paid for that somewhere along the line. And I've handed two roles to two actors who won Academy Awards for them. Mm. That was a mistake. They were two mistakes that I made. The others I don't regret.
You're clean and sober for how long now? How come that wasn't the ruin of you? I mean, how has your memory stayed so beautifully intact, given the number of brain cells you must have knocked off?
Thank God I didn't know about brain cells when I was actually drinking, because I would have been able to say, yeah, well, you know, a couple of more million, I'm not going to miss them. Well, it was always serious. It was always serious. I'm lucky to be alive, to be honest. But there's only two ways alcoholism can end. That's either in death or insanity. And I just didn't want to die from this thing. There are people who I still envy who can take a glass of wine and forget about it. I still think, Jesus Christ, you've left a half a glass of wine behind you. Are you crazy? Drink it up. I still think like that, even though I haven't had a drink for nearly 25 years. But I would have died for sure. I'm not saying that in any kind of dramatic way. Yes, I would have died. And so many of my acquaintances and friends have died. Richard Burton was a very, very heavy drinker. Alcoholic, I would probably say. He was 58 when he died. Mm. And even though I was 25 years younger than him, to me, he looked like he was 88, not 58. His body was destroyed by alcohol, whether it's addiction to drugs, prescription pills, sex, whatever it is, the addiction to not be in this moment, to be somewhere else. I suffered from that, and I realized that if I was going to survive, I was going to have to start living in the present. And although I was afraid of that, afraid of having to live without the crutch of alcohol, it has been like somebody handed me a key and said, there's your freedom. Walk out that door. You don't ever have to come back again. Like, I'm not one of these people who can't be around people who drink. I'm totally happy to be around people who are enjoying themselves. But once it gets to a certain point, you think to yourself, how the hell did I listen to these idiots for so long? Like, we'd be in a pub and you'd say, yeah, hold on for a minute though, you know, like, not all parrots are green. Those kind of stupid conversations. They'll go on to 3 o'clock in the morning. What was I talking about? Your man, he's one leg shorter than the other. What's that guy's name? Yeah, all that kind of nonsense.
You could have been a comedian as well as a writer and an actor.
Well, it's a good balance to what you said at the beginning, because I think you were saying you were kind of saying, you know, well, you know, you're a bit of a Hamlet without any of the good speeches. I think that there's humor in everything, and there's sadness in everything, and the sadness in things is the passing of things. And the humor is in saying, you know, really an awful lot of what we do and say and think is terribly important is a joke. or can be laughed at.
You've been interviewed in recent years about a couple of episodes in your life on the set of the hit movie The Usual Suspects. You said actor Kevin Spacey's inappropriate sexual behaviour halted production. You were never really aware of what Spacey got up to or Harvey Weinstein.
I did three films with Harvey Weinstein, and although I knew that Harvey was a bully, he was a manipulative bully. And he could be quite, you know, the thing about Harvey is that he could be quite charming. We tend to see him now as this, you know, appalling monster. He was charming, and he could laugh, and he enjoyed a joke and so forth. That's as far as it went. I saw him bully people. But the sexual crimes that he committed happened in secrecy. Nobody knew about them. There may have been rumors and whispers, but nobody could say anything. Nobody could prove anything, because there's a lot of rumors and whispers go around, even in the smallest village. But in the movie business, these rumors go around. There weren't that many rumors about Harvey. What the rumor was that Harvey would try his luck, even though he was married, because people would say, oh, Harvey's married. And a lot of people knew his wife. It was a lovely woman. They say, oh, Harvey's married, but, you know, he's kind of like, behaves like a producer on the set. That was the extent of it. What nobody knew, really, except the enablers. And I reserve a certain disgust for those people who enabled Harvey. And remember, it was also not regarded as anything strange for a producer or a director to meet an actress or an actor in a hotel room. I met many directors in hotel rooms. Needless to say, I didn't have any of those experiences. But those girls were vulnerable. They were in a locked room with this guy who believed that he had the power to turn them into stars or not, if he so chose. But he was also a violent rapist. But nobody knew that. That's why people say, oh, well, why didn't people come out and say what was going on? The girls were terrified to say anything because Harvey could end your career with one phone call. There was also the fact that they probably wouldn't be believed. The idea that it was your own fault. Why did you go into all that stuff? Plus, the Me Too movement had not happened. There wasn't that solidarity among women to come out and say, also, I was attacked. And so predatory behavior. You know, the thing about it is everybody looks to Hollywood and says, oh, well, Hollywood is the pit of, you know, depravity. But we have to say that the same kind of behavior went on in corporations and in offices. And they don't have to be in big, glamorous capitals like Hollywood. They can be in a small town in somewhere obscure. When one person abuses the power over another person, it doesn't matter where that happens. And there was that notion, even when it was kind of rumored and known, there was a kind of an acceptance of it. Oh, that's him, you know. There was very little thought for the victim. Oh, that's who he is, you know him, like, you know what. But I remember hearing that kind of language when I was growing up. Yeah. They would say, oh, don't get near, you know, your man, he's like, oh, that guy. It's always been going on, and it's still going on. And the reality is it probably will still go on. But at least the outing of these people has now made it a little bit easier for people to come forward and say, you know, this happened to me. And there's nothing shameful about it. And there's nothing, it's not a moral failing on your own part. You were the victim of a criminal.
It's a remarkable memoir of yours, Walking with Ghosts, and your honesty about still walking with them all. Very good to talk with you. I'm sorry we're out of time, because it's been a lovely conversation. Gabriel Byrne, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Jim. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I don't know anybody in New Zealand, but I feel I do. So hello, everybody in New Zealand.
Gabriel Byrne.